Good evening. Maybe I'll start with a sound check. Is it okay in the back? Can you hear me, or can I get this if it's okay, or this if it? Yes. No, you can't hear. I'm hoping this is better, but I'm not convinced that it is. I'll try to really remember to speak up. Okay, thank you. And if my voice drops, don't be shy. You know, feel free to wave your hand or something like this. I don't want to cause more suffering. Yep, it's a bit rattly. Hopefully this will be better. Okay, there we go. Good evening, good evening. I can't stop smiling. I don't know, I just feel happy to be here and to be practicing with you all. It's such a beautiful thing to spend this time on retreat. It's not easy, it's not always fun, but it's a beautiful thing. Thank you for your practice. So I'd like to start with an excerpt from this sutta that I find very powerful, and I've adapted it a little bit for this talk this evening. I've abbreviated it. It has a lot of repetition, as many suttas do. And in the sutta, it has this repetition 37 times. But with this one word being changed, like in the same way that when we chant the refuges, Buddham, Saranam, Gacchami, Dhamman, Saraman, Gacchami. Right? We just change that one word. Everything's the same, except we just change one word. And so I like to, when I see these things that have a lot of repetition, I like to imagine people chanting it and kind of like getting into the rhythm and getting into the groove, which is really different than reading something that's over and over again. But chanting, right, is a very different experience. And that's how these were preserved, these teachings were preserved. And maybe there's a certain impact when we hear the same thing over and over again. So the sutta goes like this. Just a portion of it. I will teach you the peaceful and the path leading to the peaceful. And what is the peaceful? The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. I will teach you the sublime and the path leading to the sublime. And what is the sublime? The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. I will teach you freedom and the path to freedom. And what is freedom? The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. I will teach you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. And what is the unconditioned? The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. I will teach you Nibbana and the path leading to Nibbana. And what is Nibbana? the ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. I appreciate this very much, these like synonyms of awakening, this synonyms of freedom. Not only the different words, but describing it as the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. And for me, that's a way in which we can make these ideas, these concepts, nibbana, freedom, we can make them a little bit more tangible. We can maybe like bring them more into our experience, into our lives, into our practice, away from some ideal that we have heard of or maybe aspire to someday, and turn them into something real. And something that I appreciate so much about this practice that's really meaningful for me is that the goal, freedom, peace, nibbana, unconditioned, and the means, the practice, are intimately related. Like, of course it is. How could it be otherwise? So we practice for freedom by discovering all the little bits of freedom that are already arising in our lives and learning about how that freedom arises, what supports it. Can practice with and explore with the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion by finding when is greed, hatred, and delusion lessened? When is there a diminishment of it? When does it seem like it's softened? It doesn't have quite such a grip on us. This is a way to practice for more freedom, for more ease. So the Buddha, he had this emphasis away from concepts and philosophies, big complex philosophies, and instead a real emphasis on experience. That's why you come on retreats to meditate, right? If it was just about philosophy, as teachers could have sent you a textbook, you memorize it, have a quiz, okay, you pass, great, you're awakened. Right, but it's not like that. It's about our experiences and our practice. And so I'd like to quote or kind of like talk a little bit about another sutta that kind of highlights this particular shift from this concepts to practice. And so to give a little bit of a setting, the Buddha is traveling, and when he arrives at towns, he would teach. Sometimes he did this in his career, probably many of you know this. And at this one time, he arrives in a town when the people there go to see him. They recognize him as a spiritual teacher of some sort. But they say to him that there have been lots of teachers that have been coming to town. And they've been explaining and teaching their own doctrines. And not only have they been teaching their own doctrines, their own philosophies, but they've been putting down everybody else's teachings, saying that only theirs is the truth and everybody else's is wrong. And they've been hearing teacher after teacher come through town saying, no, only mine is true. Everything else is wrong. It's not surprising that they feel a little confused or suspicious, critical. I imagine I would, if I were hearing lots of people, you know, criticizing everybody else and insisting that only what they are saying is true. So they ask the Buddha, if all these people, like, who is telling the truth? And the Buddha responds by listing 10 things to not follow. I'm not going to go through this list of 10, but we can summarize this list of 10 as, don't just follow something because it's the tradition to do something. Don't just follow a teacher or teachings that are just abstract philosophy that seemed completely disconnected from one's lived experience. And don't follow teachers or teachings that are just charismatic. They make you feel good, or somehow you're able to get swept away by them. So he wants to move away from this idea of this simple idea of just adopt certain beliefs, and instead make these teachings your own. Discover them for yourself. Make them alive and relevant and pragmatic and pertinent. It was this movement away from just passively absorbing teachings towards taking responsibility for oneself and paying attention to a lived experience, what you know, what you've experienced. So, in terms of this direct experience, a bit more specifically, looking at when we have an experience or we do something, what are its consequences? What happens? Is it helpful? Was that action helpful? Was it not helpful? Did it harm others? Did it harm yourself? He's also encouraging them to look at what do other people say about these actions. This recognition that what we do in secret or what we're hiding often, not always, but often is not helpful for ourselves or for others. So he's encouraging them to be aware of, would a wise person think this is a good idea? What would others say? Would they blame you if they knew about this? So getting back to the sutta specifically, so rather than the Buddha just saying, here's what the truth is, you should follow it, he engages them. And he engages them by asking them questions. He asks Kalamas, what do you think? What do you think? When greed arises in a person, is it for their welfare or for their harm? Of course they're going to say it's for their harm. When hatred arises in a person, is it for their welfare or for their harm? It's for their harm, Venerable Sir. When delusion arises in a person, it's for their harm. But then he continues, because maybe even this idea of greed, hatred, and delusion is a little bit conceptual, a little bit, could be seem like, well, what is that exactly? How do we know when actions, behavior is coming out of greed, hatred, or delusion? So he says, Kalamas, a greedy person overcome by greed, with a mind obsessed by greed, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another's spouse, speaks falsehoods, and encourages others to do the same. Will that lead to their harm and suffering? Yes, Venerable Sir. And then the Buddha continues with the opposite. Well, what do you think, Kalamas? when non-greed arises in a person, is it for their welfare or for their benefit? It's for their welfare. Because a person without greed, not overcome by greed, not having a mind obsessed by greed, does not destroy life, does not take what is not given, does not transgress with another spouse, does not speak falsehoods, and doesn't encourage others to do otherwise. So many of you will recognize, he's leading here, some four of the five precepts are here. This is the Kalama Sutta. This is that part of the Kalama Sutta that we often don't hear about, where the Buddha is giving some guidance on how to show up in the world. And you also recognize probably the greed, hatred, and delusion are these three root defilements that underlie behaviors, actions that lead away from freedom. But I appreciate that the Buddha goes even further in this sutta. Gives them some additional, how to approach this, how to make this their own, how to live with these guidelines. And he says, Kalamas, when you know for yourselves that these actions are unskillful, Brian talked about this a little bit this morning, that skillful or unskillful, we can use this as a criteria. When you know for yourselves that these actions are reproachable, when these actions, if you do them, if others would blame you for them, these actions, when you know for yourselves, would be criticized by the sensible and wise persons. These actions, if undertaken, lead to harm, lead to suffering, then abandon them. When you know for yourselves that they are skillful, blameless, recommended, lead to welfare and happiness, then live in accordance with them. I'm calling these the Kalama criteria. Is it blameless? Is it skillful or unskillful? What would other people say? Would they blame us or would they criticize us if they knew about it? If we don't want them to know about it, does that say something? If undertaken, does it lead to welfare? Does it lead to benefit and happiness? So these aren't abstract philosophies. These are tested. This idea of testing them out by seeing what the consequences are, seeing what other people say about them. These ways of thinking about one's actions are immediately verifiable. Very often we can see, that did cause harm. Sometimes for ourselves we can feel there's this contraction that didn't feel right. Or we can see immediately the harm it causes in someone else. Or maybe we immediately can feel the happiness. This felt like this was the right thing to do, or I can see it was the right thing to do. So the Buddha isn't giving the precepts just as these rules to follow, as this abstract philosophy, just to have rules to follow. Instead, he's giving them as a way for us to understand this movement away from greed, hatred, and delusion, towards non-greed, non-hatred and delusion, because that's the movement away from suffering and towards freedom. So it's this movement of helping them to see this relationship between being filled with greed, hatred, and delusion and the harm it causes. This movement of taking it away from concepts and rules and into something tangible. So in this way, we might say that Buddhist ethics or ethical behavior is very pragmatic. It's about supporting the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. So as practitioners, we can ask, does this action lead to suffering? Does it lead to increased happiness? And this pragmatic approach is more conducive, is more likely to lead to investigation than to guilt. The encouragement here is to explore, investigate what happens when I behave in this way, as opposed to this terrible feeling, oh no, I broke a precept, something awful is going to happen, I'm a really bad person. Having this pragmatic approach not only helps us to find more freedom, but helps us to investigate, encourages this investigation, and many of you will know investigation is one of the factors of awakening. So it's a support for awakening. Because there can be a lot of unhelpful ways to hold ethics, ethical behavior. There can be this building up of a sense of self, like, I'm so great, look at me. I'm never make a mistake, or I'm following the rules precisely, look at me. Or don't look at me, I'm awful, I'm a terrible person because I broke that precept. Both of these have this really strong sense of self, and that's not the direction towards more freedom. Or another unhelpful way to hold ethics is to say, these are the rules and everybody has to follow them and everybody who doesn't follow them is somehow bad. So instead, it's this movement of taking these ideas of freedom, nibbana, peace, tying it to its non-greed, non-hatred, and delusion, a way that we can practice and notice non-greed, non-hatred, and delusion is noticing when greed, hatred, and delusion arise. And those are born, they get expressed as breaking the precepts. But this movement from being with concepts to experiential knowledge just happens naturally also in our practice. And maybe you've seen this in yourself, that there's this progression or this movement of, we might say, I don't know if this is the right expression, but this ethical development. I know this certainly was true for me, that early in the practice we might have this idea, okay, well, if I just follow the rules, then that'll be okay. And I certainly did. I remember that I had the great good fortune to take this course that we were taking on to take the refuges and the precepts, to kind of like explore them. What are the refuges and the precepts? And then this was, a 6-week course, and at the end, we were going to formally do it, to take the refuges and precepts. And when it came to the ceremony, it actually ended up being much more meaningful to me than I imagined. I don't know why. It just was. And I felt like, okay, wow. Okay, I guess I better take these precept things seriously. Before I was, you know, I thought of myself as an ethical person, but certainly I'm not going around doing any, you know, gross things, you know, really obvious things that are unethical. But I noticed how I was prone to telling little white lies. I'm sorry I'm late. The traffic was bad. I live in the Bay Area. The traffic is always bad. So this is a legitimate thing. But I that wasn't why I was late. I was just disorganized and left late. And I didn't want to admit that, so I felt like, okay, Diana, you got to be a little bit more organized and leave the house at a reasonable time. So I started leaving the house at a little bit more reasonable time. I started to feel better about myself driving, not being so frantic, being late. And this idea, okay, this whole no intoxicants, okay, I guess I'm not going to drink anymore. A friend of mine was having a birthday party, and I knew there was going to be a lot of alcohol and drinking there. And I said, you know, I think I'm not going to go. No, thank you. Oh, come on, Diana, you need to go. You should go. It'll be really meaningful for me. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. It's going to be awkward, and I don't want to drink anymore. Diana, really, please, you got to come. Like, okay. But I'm going to bring lots of fun, flavored sparkling water. This was before LaCroix existed and stuff, right? And this was kind of a big deal. I had to go hunt it down and find this, and I brought a lot. So this party, it ended up being kind of fun. I happily drank sparkling water with a little squeeze of lime and lemon in there, right? And it was fun. At the end of the party, I don't think I will ever forget this. Even now I feel a little, I feel touched by this. Somebody came up to me and said, you know, Diana, I just met you, but thank you for not drinking. I've been trying to get sober for a long time and my life is a little bit out of control, but it was so meaningful for me to have somebody else who wasn't drinking. And I reflected on, I've seen people's lives destroyed, you know, with intoxicants. I haven't had a drink since. I have these precepts, but just knowing that somehow my behaving in this particular way supports other people in finding their way with their life to decrease the suffering in their life, it's really impactful. And early in my practice, I was part of this meditation community, and I found myself really wanting to hang out there, even though I had nothing in common with anybody, really. Keeping in mind, I was a research scientist, right? And here's this spiritual community. But I couldn't quite put my finger on, like, what is it about this community? Why do I keep on going back? Yes, I love the teachings, but I could hear them online, so why am I going? I felt safe there because people were doing their best to not harm others. They were careful with their speech to not gossip, and they were taking care of, I don't know, somebody left their umbrella. You knew that the umbrella would be there the next time they came back. So this idea of, you know, practicing for the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion certainly supports our practice, but it really supports others too. So in the beginning, it might just be about following the rules, as it was for me. But then with practice, we start to see how it benefits ourselves and benefits others. But then even with more practice, we start to see how just behaving in an ethical way, I'll use that expression, starts to become just an expression of this goodness that we discover inside of ourselves. Somehow, maybe we always knew that it was there, but with practice we can tap into it and have it be a guide for our lives. So we become more sensitive to maybe the beauty, the goodness inside of ourselves. We also become more sensitive to the suffering that happens when we are doing something that causes harm. We become more sensitive to the harm we're causing to ourselves. We also become more sensitive or easier able to tap into care and compassion. So as our practice develops, we go from wanting to follow the rules, to see how it benefits ourselves, to see how it just becomes an expression out of our increased sensitivity, our increased awareness, this goodness flowing out of us without any idea that it has to be ethical. It's just what is arising. And then, of course, a free person, a person who has complete freedom, all greed, hatred, and delusion is destroyed, doesn't exist anymore, so they can't help but behave ethically. So we could say also that, you know, this practice, we could say, is all about ethical development. We could map it that way. This kind of this integration of, you know, mindfulness and practice. This really, we could also map it in terms of what's our behavior, how are we showing up in the world? Which can be, I guess, in some ways it's a beautiful way to think about it. But there's a way also that, like, bringing ethics as an integral part of practice as opposed to just that other thing that you do that's when you're other than meditation, but something that's really integral is we can, practicing with the precepts, can highlight for us what's happening whenever we feel like, oh, I want to break a precept, or we have broken a precept. We might use that as a way to support our practice. I got this idea from Joanna Hardy, who teaches about this, and notice when it feels like when we are considering breaking a precept, like using that as a mindfulness spell, like what's going on with us? I say this, what's going on with us, this recognition that it takes time between when we learn something about ourselves and when we can change our behavior, right? This is a really painful part of practice. We get to watch ourselves do something that we know is not helpful, but we keep on doing it anyway. This is just part of practice, and this can be a difficult part, but to recognize that just because we have awareness or understanding doesn't mean that we can immediately shift our behavior, but it starts there. It starts with this understanding. So for example, why do people harm others? Fear. Maybe they have fear. Maybe they feel like they want to control. They feel out of control. They want to control. Maybe they feel like they want to have power because often they feel powerless. So if we feel like, oh, maybe we have harmed or we're considering harming or we feel this urge arise, maybe we can learn a little bit about ourselves. With practice, we talk so much about clinging, seeing what we're clinging to. Well, maybe there's a way in which this fear is having us cling and not see clearly, or wanting to control something because we feel out of control, or everything feels out of control. So why do people harm when we harm? Maybe there's something like this that's happening. Why do people take things that are not freely offered? Maybe they're a little bit numb to their own experience, not even noticing that taking something doesn't really feel good to ourselves. You have to hide it. Or I have this story that's when I was working in a lab, there was somebody, you know, laboratories were kind of like a closed system, right? There was a team that works in this one lab, you know, day in and day out. And so if the team doesn't quite get along, you know, it can fester, especially if there isn't a lot of, you know, skillful, well, maybe I'll just say some of the stereotypes about scientists are true. So there was somebody in the lab that I was like really angry with, and in a lab you're not allowed to have any food or drink, of course, right? You don't want chemicals, don't mix, right, with food and drink. So we would, you know, have breaks or snacks in other places. And this one time, this person in the lab that I was particularly annoyed with, I found his coffee cup in an unusual place. And I thought, oh, I will make this even a more unusual place so that he won't find it. Kind of, you know, like in some ways, kind of like, I don't know, taking it, right? So that, like, kind of guaranteed he would, like, the likelihood of him finding it would be so low. And then 2 days later, I couldn't find my calculator. But the first thing that comes to my mind, oh, he took it. He knew that I did this for his coffee mug, so he must have taken it, this retribution, and oh my gosh, okay, now what am I going to do? Right? And it just kind of escalated, and I was so angry, and I can't believe it. Why would he take my calculator? I need it. Of course, I found my calculator under the stack of paper on my messy desk, right? But all the time I had spent days, like, trying to plot, what am I going to do, and this is terrible, and see how this is just fuel or evidence that this person is a bad person or something like this. But I wouldn't, if I hadn't have moved to where his coffee mug was, I wouldn't have all of a sudden started to think that he was doing things to me, and, you know, just shifted. All of a sudden I felt like everybody was against me and I had this thing to hide. And I think we can see how this happens, right? Maybe there's reasons why people take things that aren't freely offered. Maybe they're rationalizing, this person has so much, they won't even recognize it's gone. Or this institution has so much, they won't even recognize that it's gone. Somehow we're kind of rationalizing something that we know really isn't the way towards greater freedom and ease. Or maybe people take things that aren't freely offered because they have this strong sense of lack. Like, there isn't enough. I need more of whatever it is. Maybe we can be sensitive to that and pay attention to that sense of lack. Or maybe there's a person has an addiction. And when you have an addiction and you have to feed that addiction, that, you know, creates the conditions for a lot of unskillful behavior. So this way we can look at what when we feel like we're going to break a precept, what's underneath it? when we're unwise with our sexuality, or when people are unwise with their sexuality, and I'm assuming right now that we're talking about sex between consenting adults. I'm not talking about obvious sexual misconduct, but I'm talking about using our sexual energy maybe in a way that's not helpful. Maybe there's a sense of loneliness inside that needs to be addressed and is trying to be addressed in this with some sexual, maybe that's inappropriate, or maybe there's just trying to connect with others in a way that seems like the only way available. Or maybe there's this need of some reassurance of our value or our worthiness or attractiveness. So using sex as a way to boost up or reassure ourselves. But I can imagine that all of us want to live a life of love. And so looking at the way that we use our sexual energy is, can that be an expression of love and tenderness and care and joy between people? Why do people not tell the truth? Why do we sometimes tip the truth? I was telling these white lies because I didn't want to admit how disorganized I was, or was busy doing something else, or didn't think it was important enough to leave the house on time. But sometimes we tip the truth because we want to be liked, or we want to get our way. So we just tell one side of the story so it makes it obvious that, you know, a person should behave a particular way. Or maybe we tip the truth because we want to somehow manipulate others, because we don't really know how to speak directly or find it too uncomfortable to say something directly or clearly, or asking for something directly. Or maybe we tip the truth because we're trying to hide something. And why do people use intoxicants? There's the obvious intoxicants, alcohol and drugs. But there's also plenty of others that we use to kind of check out or numb out or disconnect from others and from ourselves, from our experience. And we might use food or shopping or surfing the internet, just being connected on our phone, watching YouTube videos, working, right? There's all these ways in which we disconnect. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things, inherently wrong with them. But is there something we're trying to avoid? Or are we procrastinating, or are we trying to avoid responsibility? So again, this idea that the precepts aren't these rules, but there's something to help us explore the expression of greed, hatred, and delusion in our lives, and also to help them to notice, to understand ourselves better, and to notice what's going on with ourselves. When we feel like we are considering breaking a precept, just as a support for ourselves, support for our life, for us to have our best life with the greatest amount of freedom. And so maybe as a summary, as a high-level summary, I could say that the Buddha was less interested in abstract philosophies. I mean, we certainly have all these lists and all these things, but most of them are related as a support to our life, how we live it, how we show up in the world, and providing some tangible experiences as opposed to just thoughts or beliefs or doctrines. And he provided guidelines for our behavior, not because, you know, these are rules to follow for the sake of rules, but just to help us cause less harm to ourselves, cause less harm to others, to have more freedom for ourselves, have more freedom for others, and to help undermine these expressions of greed, hatred, and delusion. To help us to see the way that greed, hatred, and delusion might be showing up in our lives. Enlightenment is about the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. Behaving ethically is about not expressing greed, hatred, and delusion. And a few years ago, Gil Fronstahl, Max Erdstein, and I, we taught a course that was entitled The Equivalence of Ethics and Enlightenment. And we explored this whole integral way of ethics and awakening and how freedom gets expressed. This turned out to be such a rich course, kind of like explore this in a different way. Because sometimes we can get lost in thinking it's just about concepts or ideas, and it turns out it's really about our lives and how we are showing up for ourselves, showing up for others. Is there more suffering, less suffering, more freedom or less freedom? And maybe we could even summarize all that about practice is about care. Caring about our suffering. Caring about the suffering for others, caring for others, caring for ourselves. And Gil Fronstahl translates this word anukampa. It's in this sprinkled throughout the suttas as care. And the Buddha teaches or says that he teaches out of anukampa because he has care. He's caring about us. He's caring about everybody. This idea of care. So I'd like to close with this story that's written by this award-winning poet and writer. I really love her poems. And here's a really short story. The poet is Naomi Shihab Nye. Maybe some of you have heard of her. The story goes like this. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal after learning my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, because one pauses these days, but gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma, was crumpled to the floor, wailing. Help, said the flight agent. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. Shudawa, shubit habibti stanichwe min fadlik shubitsui. This is my, you know, kind of doing the what she wrote here, so my apologies to anybody who speaks Arabic. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely and she needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, no, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons, just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they have 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar. And smiling, there is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it. And they were covered with powdered sugar. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Something to stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary travelers, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying and the confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all these other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. Just took some care. Let's just sit for a moment.